You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to 90 Day Soulmate with Lisette
and Jim.
Today we're talking about got confidence. It's a show all about confidence. How to get confidence? What is confidence?
That is interesting.
Are we born with confidence?
We develop the confidence.
Can we? And how? I think we're going to approach this subject in a very different way, as we always do. Our lack of confidence right now.
We have
technical difficulties getting on the show on the air today, which is kind of interesting because it's like, what do? You try resetting your mixer. You try resetting the computer and the cameras and the microphones over and over and over again. And you get really frustrated. And then you do the same thing you just did and suddenly it works. At least we hope it does, and you're still hearing us. Welcome to our show. So the thing that we wanted to look at was, what is confidence? What does it impact? How does it impact people? Is it from the time you were born to today? Can you develop better confidence? What are things that have helped along the way? Let's get right into it. Self-confidence can be looked at two different things. One, general self-confidence, which we're going to call G. We're making up a term called G, which is general self-confidence, which is a stable personality trait that develops in early childhood. We'll discuss how that happens in a little bit. And then specific self-confidence, S, or self-confidence S, which is a changing mental and emotional state associated with the specific task, situation, or context of what's going on right now. So if you're at work and say you're an accountant and you're working with numbers and you're talking to one of the salespeople, you may be really confident because you are the accountant, you know the numbers. But when they ask you for certain sales strategies, you may say,
I don't know.
Right? So self-confidence specific, or S, is in relationship to specific things, which can be developed over time. And can general self-confidence be developed over time?
Like the person that say, I can speak 5 languages.
I can do that.
That is S or G?
That would be G.
Okay.
Because in the actuality of it, she couldn't speak 5 languages, but she just
She thought she could.
She could try. She had all that confidence. So the general self-confidence is how you would approach any situation. So let's go back into the development of self-confidence from an early age. It is developed both general and specific. It's developed through automatic, unconscious, internal dialogues and daily judgments of ourself, or how others react to us and therefore give us more or less confidence. Then we're impacted through our thoughts, emotions, and behavior. New and unusual circumstances are impacted by G, general, and everyday typical performance are impacted by S. So let's actually talk about that a little bit.
Okay. So what can the circumstance, you can put one example about G.
So G, general self-confidence, would be you say you've been driving your car for weeks and all of a sudden you have a breakdown on the side of the road with a friend. And you've never changed a tire, never been in that situation before. If you take control, if you get on your phone, call AAA because you know that's what you do, if you give the evidence that you're confident in, you know how to handle something, or at least you're not afraid to handle it, That would be general self-confidence, when you take on a new task that you haven't been faced with before. Say there's a problem at work. Somebody tripped on the stairs and fell down the stairs at a hotel. And you're the, what do they call it, the front door person. And you've never had anybody trip down the stairs. Now, do you just go, oh my, they tripped down the stairs? Or do you rush over and say, how can I help you? Stay here. Let me go get ice. Let me get somebody who can help. Let me call somebody for you. Who can I, like, how do you approach that situation? Someone with general confidence. Self-confidence may give the appearance of knowing what they're doing. And the point of that is, it's not just giving the appearance, it's being comfortable trying to figure out that situation that you've never had.
I guess, and different that somebody can feel timid and say, I don't want to be involved in this situation, so I don't take any action.
Didn't we talked about this at one point where there was a situation that occurred, and I can't remember where it was and what the situation was at the moment, but maybe you'll get it. And there were all these people reacting to it. Somebody was, oh, we were talking about the person who came into the presentation and they had been drinking a little bit and they came off the street and one person is yelling at him, get out of here, get out of here. And another is scared and they go hide. And then somebody else goes, hey, what's going on? Can I help you? And there's one person who will put the rest of the room at ease. And that's the person with the confidence. It can appear to be sometimes like bravery. But it doesn't mean you're going to take a risk. It's just that you don't question your own skills in a situation you haven't been in before. You quickly assess, is there someone else here who may have more skill than me? Maybe I'll get them involved. But it's the confidence to do that. Where the specific self-confidences would be like everyday tasks. So you go to work and again, you're the accountant and you're good with numbers. And you're really good with it, and you have a question on numbers, you know what you're talking about, and it's your specific task. But the sales organization says, I want you to give a presentation on marketing and our return on investment on a number of the investments we made. Also, what our budgets are going to be for sales and marketing next year. And these are things, you don't like speaking in front of people. So you may have all that specific self-confidence in accounting.
But not
in those other things. I don't feel confident and comfortable giving a performance, presenting in front of other people about subjects that maybe I could understand.
Okay, but the important point maybe is if you have the knowledge, your level of confidence is different.
That's getting to one of our points about developing self-confidence. Number one thing will be become very knowledgeable in the subject that you want to become confident in. So the number one thing to do if you want to become more confident in relationships, read books like 90 Day Soulmate. You can enjoy learning more about relationships by reading While Victoria Dreams. Read other books, other things on psychology, on relationships. That helps you become more calm about the subject, because when you are more knowledgeable, you're not as worried about the unknown. And sometimes that's the biggest thing that makes us sabotage a relationship or a job, is that it's the unknown. We don't know about it, so we act timidly. And when we do, it looks like we're underperforming, because maybe we are underperforming, but we're also showing people we're nervous, and then you have that somewhat neurotic behavior.
And also you can find somebody that maybe is knowledgeable for something, but is nervous, you know? So I see in some training they do, and then you see the person in the five-day training, all exercise pretty good, all answer example, and then in the final test the people fail. And it's because the nervous sabotage. So I said maybe the person is knowledgeable, but maybe the confidence sabotage your knowledge too.
They have performance anxiety.
So that's the other side of the
view. That is absolutely people who don't test well. You know, so they maybe do really well in class. They have all sorts of notes. They have all sorts of knowledge. They go into the test and then they're anxious and nervous. Maybe they didn't sleep the night before because of being anxious and nervous. They don't feel like they can eat because they're going to get sick, so they don't eat. So all these things add up to, you know, the self-confidence and the lack of doing the things right to be in the right state then has a performance that is under what you should be doing based upon your skill level. Let's continue on here. What is high self-confidence important for? If you're in a position of leadership, it's essential for effective leadership. It helps you influence corroborators and collaborators. Corroborators, if you're going into a court case and being confident of your situation and what actually happened, it helps you have people who support you. But collaborators and people you work with, teammates, very important. It helps you influence them if you're confident. It attracts followers. So confident people who present, people who are celebrities, people who are in politics, who are confident, have more followers. People who are on social media who are confident have more followers than those who are really uncomfortable talking about what they're talking about. And then finally, you're able to, as Lizette said before, build task-specific self-confidences, which will strengthen your job performance. So your job performance will become strengthened as you develop these task-specific confidences by learning more about that it is, sorry, learning more about what it is that you do. So if you're an engineer, read more about engineering. If you're in sales, read more about sales. Learn more, go to sales training. If you're in customer service,
how to connect with people, how to talk. Right? Yeah.
There's some great customer service trainings on how to see the problem from the side of the customer, how to diffuse a tense situation.
Yeah, how to handle the stress.
How to handle stress. Let's see what else we got here. Oh, so do you know that there's a biological basis for tendencies?
Mm-hmm.
So it's thought that a lot of personality traits, a lot of these things that are part of who we are inherent, that there's a biological basis to behavioral tendencies, that we are like the people we come from. Part of that is genetic. Part of that may be the environment we grew up in. But because of genetic methods that are available today, we can test assumptions. You've probably heard of twin and adoption research, where you have same zygote twins, meaning a zygote splits rather than two separate eggs getting fertilized at the same time. It's one egg gets fertilized with one sperm, and then it splits into two separate entities, which turn out to be the exact same DNA. Well, when those two children are born, they share all the same genetic matter. And then they look at twins that grow up in the same household versus twins that are adopted to different families. They can look at those environments. They can look at the twins. They can do a study. And then they can determine, based upon personality traits, tendencies, on a whole bunch of personality traits and also confidence and other temperament type behaviors, they can see how much are attributed to same genetic
or environment.
And they always come up with approximately the same numbers. And I've heard these numbers a little bit different than this, but this is the last study we pulled up, that 20 to 60% is based upon, or should I say, explainable by genetics or DNA. That means there's a tendency to follow the genetic basis, and you are like the people you come from in a number of things. Or if you have a twin who's exactly the same by biology as you, you tend to be 20 to 60% similar to them in comparison to somebody who doesn't have the same DNA. But environment makes up a big portion of that as too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's higher or lower depending on how strong the environment was one way or another. So if there is a completely vanilla environment where there's no real push one way or another, then the genetic aspect may be a stronger aspect. Mm. And when the environment is positive or negative one way or the other for a given trait, it can really have a huge bearing on the outcome. Then there is the unexplained, and we like to look at the unexplained as 20 to 60%, also based upon who you are down deep, that part of you that is not the material part of you, the soul.
90 Days Soulmate is brought to you by 90 Days Solutions.
So we were talking about different things that are inborn and innate in the range of 20 to 60%. Here are the following things they did in studying newborns and infants, that these temperament dimensions of emotionality, activity of the baby, shyness, you know, how much they're facing people or kind of shading their eyes and not looking at, the sociability, attention, persistence in looking in a direction, the approach, are they approachable? Adaptability, how adaptable are they to changes in circumstances? Distress, how distressed are they? How often do they cry? Are they, you know, not feeling well? What's the frequency intensity of smiles, which is called a positive effect? Frequency and intensity of smiles. But what this one study showed that said these other temperaments are a 20 to 60% genetically based temperament also said there's no rhythmicity. No rhythmicity.
What is that?
That rhythmicity was not linked to genetic. Uh-huh. Rhythmicity is, and I wrote this one down just so we have it here, that the ability to move in synchrony with the beat of a music. So it's being able to dance, be able to move, and that they test little tiny tots and they put music on and see if they're with it or they're not with it. Well, this one study said that it was not shown that it had any genetic bearing. But what's funny about studies is for every study, there's another study. Yeah. And a recent study done with data from 23andMe with 600,000 participants, they identified 69 genetic variants that were identified in association with the ability to move in synchrony with the beat of the music. So one study, research paper, shows there is no link. And here this one shows that there is a link, but it took 69 genetic variants that were identified as being associated. So there's cultural, unique, and intricate musicality, highlights connections between rhythm and health, which was another interesting thing, is that this isn't just, these 69 variants weren't just rhythm, but there was an association with health as well.
Okay.
And it could be they were talking about movement and rhythm and the ability to be in sync was a sign of the physical mental connection that a person had, and that it was more than just being rhythmic, but it had other traits, other benefits, other things that were associated with the same grouping. So it can be an indication that if you don't have rhythm, could just be you don't have rhythm, but it could also be that there are other underlying factors that may be affecting your health. Maybe not, though. Genetics only explains some of the variability. There was a huge amount of environmental impact, such as if your parents were drummers, musicians, dancers, and you grew up in that type of environment, of course, you had exposure to and training in, which helps evoke the development and the appearance of the traits that are in those genes. And if you don't have that environment growing up, it could stop those genes. Not stop, it just, the genes don't appear, not the genes, the traits from those genes don't appear because there's nothing that prompted them to. And we'll talk about neuroplasticity in a bit too, because we'll talk about why, if traits don't appear over time, maybe they don't come even though you were born with them. that it becomes difficult, more difficult later on in your life to develop something that didn't develop when you were a child because of how quickly the brain develops when you're a child.
Okay.
Soul searching. So that 20 to 60% that's inherent. So the what is a soul anyway? And it's defined by some as the immaterial essence of a human being, the part of you that you feel is you, even though you don't think you reside in your brain, you don't think you reside in your body, that you reside external to that. You existed before and after and during. It's the part of you that existed before, during, and after your existence on Earth. It is synonymous with the mind and the self. The soul can give us our individuality, right? So what makes us human, what gives us humanity, what impacts us beyond just what the brain and body.
And this is the difference that you found in twin people. Maybe they grew up in the same house, they grew up with
same DNA, same environment, and they still have
school,
vastly
same
differences.
Career, and they have different. Yeah. So why is this different? The soul.
There's so many things that are impacted beyond our ability to understand.
Yeah.
You talked about the soul kind of being our software. So even though you have the same hardware, the same environment, there's some software running in you that's being influenced from outside forces.
Mm-hmm.
Even prehistoric peoples believed in an aspect, a distinct portion of them that existed beyond the body and only... They felt they were residing in the body and perhaps not even part of the body, that the soul resided within the body, but also exterior to the body. So it was...
Now this is maybe attached with Victoria Dream, because if you believe that something is, you can go out or in, like the source word. So Victoria have a dream that something happened in the future.
Right.
So it's in some way they can travel in the time and coming back. So that is not genetic. That is not your environment. That is something else.
So we're going to talk about quantum entanglement now. Quantum entanglement. It's not part of our presentation, but since Lizette brought it up, there is a theory put forth that if you take an atom and you take two electrons that are in the atom and you separate one electron and you move it over here, that any change you make to that electron will instantly make the electron that's left in the atom move correspondingly. If you move this one right, it moves right, move it left, it moves left, because those two electrons are, quote, quantumly entangled forever. So that's the theory, that if this one moves instantly across time and space. It doesn't travel at the speed of light. The signal's instantaneous. So we may be experiencing things in time, but atomically and in the universe, there may be no distance between any electron, any atom in the universe. There may be an instant connection universally everywhere between all of us. And if you think about that as being part of who we are, you know, the Big Bang, that there was nothing, or there was everything, but it had existed in no space, that the Big Bang created the space and created the time that we all exist in all together at the same time, but we have different versions of reality based upon our position, our viewpoint, our DNA or hardware, but there's this software in the background that's running in that unified manner. And so these dreams that talk about the future and the past, we perceive them as future and past, but perhaps it's all just unity. That there's a singularity, and we're still living in the singularity, although we experience it in space and time.
Yeah.
Okay, that was my little scientific philosophy for the moment. Continuing on, neuroplasticity, which allows us to think these things and
every
create thoughts,
show
right?
You put this slide.
I have to. Well, this is very important that we're going to define it again and again and again, because for us as scientists, engineers, in the field of psychology, that the ability for the brain to grow and change helps us grow ourselves, learn new things, solve problems, treat issues.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, So neuroplasticity is the capacity of neurons and neural networks in the brain to change their connections and behavior. One, it happens really rapidly when we're very young, but it can still happen even at my advanced age. Response to new information, sensory stimulation, development, damage, or dysfunction are some of the things that create the changes in the brain. So again, new information, new sensory stimulation, development, these things continue to grow our brain. I wanted to go one step further because this is the amazing part of the brain that sometimes when we talk about helps you think about how easy it is for us to change. We think it's really difficult, but if we're passionate about it and we really think about it and work at it, we can pick up new things.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Like I picked up the guitar a lot more during COVID, right?
Yes, guitar, piano, and construction, and everything.
And this kind of stuff. Like every week we learn something new about psychology and the brain and human behavior, and we enjoy sharing it. So, for instance, in developmental neuroplasticity, the brain sprouts branches, forms synapses. The neurons do that. They sprout branches, form synapses. They strengthen or weaken depending on their use, the frequency of use. That as things strengthen, others weaken, and those that don't get used basically go away. It's called synaptic pruning, where the actual synapses are just cut off and they go away. When we are born, we have maybe about 2,500 synapses per neuron. By the time we're 2 to 3, we have 15,000 of these connections coming from each neuron. So our neurons have these, I'm going to just call them fibers, these synapses running in all directions, connecting all of our brain, trying to wiring it. But they're very, very thin wires. Just think of them as like spider webs. Mm-hmm. As we work on strengthening, we go from this 15,000 to, by the time we're adult, only 7,500. So we lose half of them. But the ones we lose are the ones we don't use, right? You use it or lose it through synaptic pruning. So somebody goes in there and just starts snipping the ones we're not using and they go away. So the brain is built stronger in the areas of use. And what's not used goes away over time. And even now, we stop using our brain. We decide, oh, I've learned everything I ever need to learn. I'm not going to school ever again. Well, your brain, the parts of your brain that learn stuff may say, oh, I'm never using this again.
Yeah.
And they go away and you forget, right? You can forget things you learned, like the multiplication table.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
I don't know. I forgot. As we get older, neuroplasticity also continues on in something we call reinforcement. So experience, learning, and memory all focus on building areas stronger. Our brains will adapt. It may take an alternative approach. It may reassign portions of the brain based upon damage, or somebody who loses their eyesight may have more connection to their fingertips and touch and smell. So there's more synapses that are, quote, reassigned to other areas. And what they call map expansion is just think of those synapses and neurons, and you've got them going all through your skull. And the map expansion is basically you're just creating new streets, right? New streets and new destinations in the brain. Why is this important? Because of it, we can learn stuff.
Yeah.
And as we learn stuff, we can build self-confidence and confidence, both general and specific.
The G and S.
The G and S. It may be harder to develop general, at least our premises, it's harder to develop general confidence. Mm-hmm. So if you can develop specific confidence and expand those specific confidences to be more and more and more areas, that also will impact your general.
Okay.
Much more easy to do a specific area and develop your confidence there. And as you do, then trickle down or trickle up, your general self-confidence will grow.
So what do we have next?
Oh, so very interesting. How do you develop self-confidence? Well, let's look at children for the moment, mm-hmm. because a lot of experiments are done of how to develop confidence in children. Here are two studies that use different techniques. One was a music and movement activity, which was shown to develop expression in children, develop self-confidence in children, and also help develop imagination. And another study was done about creative drama, which helped develop confidence and emotional intelligence. We'll discuss why in a second here. So do we want to talk about drama now? We'll go through this and then we'll come back and do the other one after. How about that?
Yeah.
So how does drama, how does the involvement in drama, the introduction to drama, being involved in plays and different things, skits and pantomime, how does that build confidence? Well, one, it builds confidence, and if you see this whole list of what it does, you can see how this all fits into somebody's ability to handle situations, and the handling of situations gives off the appearance of confidence also. So confidence is built, you're able to face diverse life situations and problems in drama, so you can face things that you may face in the future without actually having to face them. So it's like practice. You get to practice things. Communication and presentation skills are built. Standing up in front of people. Creativity. Some of these types of activities work on creativity. Critical thinking and decision making by facing some of these
situations,
having to come up with how to deal with it, because there are some things called, what is that called, where you're just...
Improvisation.
Yeah, improvisation. So you're given a situation, you have to improv your way through it. You might say, okay, this time I'm going to be angry about it. Next time I'm going to be sad about it. Next time I'm going to tell this person what to do. Next time I'm going to ask them what they would do. And I try different things. I try different techniques and I build I build an array of solutions.
90 Days Soulmate is brought to you by 90 Days Solutions.
The building of confidence in drama. How does it do it? Well, self-respect, self-esteem is built as you do more with people in front of other people. You have individual expression. You're able to express yourself, especially when you have the interpretation or you're able to do...
Or you have to also understand the character that you do. So you learn in different way how you performance other personality.
Sure. Overcome personal barriers. Mm-hmm. And it can make you courageous if you're going, okay, I have to step up in front. I got to play this role. Playing different characters allows you to explore different aspects of your own personality. How do you face a diversity of life situations and problems? So creative situations and plays, you're exposed to the issues of the world that maybe you wouldn't be exposed to without being involved in drama. You have an opportunity to look at, analyze, and explore different answers and different routes to take, especially when you're determining or maybe even writing your own play. And you get to learn and react to life's problems.
And also the therapy, the we'd say, what is the name? The therapy is constellation.
Family? Constellation therapy.
Yeah.
Where
so
you play a role.
Is the foundation of this technique is that you play a role to somebody. So I am right now your father or your brother or your sister, you are my child, and then you perform on this character, you understand better what happened in the family. You know?
So in a character, you can do what potentially you can't do as yourself. Like, I may be seen sometimes as liking to be presenting and talking and this and that, but I'm actually pretty much shy when it comes one-to-one people, typically. Typically,
okay.
I was in a play where I played the captain of this boat. We had a dinner before the play, and I had to interact with the people at the dinner as the captain of the boat. So as the captain of the boat, I can say, hey, welcome aboard, come on, let's have dinner. And you can act in a certain way that you don't act like normally, and it can kind of expand. You can believe that's part of your personality. All these roles become part of you, and they become lessons and models of how to behave. Mm-hmm. Communication and presentation skills can be developed through drama. You can learn, I'm going to drop right down here, learn congruent body language for effective communication. You can practice different facial expressions to see what works, and you can experiment with your emotions to learn how to convey your feelings in different ways, and you see what works, and how what you're learning in drama you can then utilize in real life when you're giving a presentation, when you're communicating.
So that means if you're acting confident, you become confident?
Well, you've heard the expression fake it until you make it.
Mm-hmm.
There is I would say learn it, right? You're mm-hmm. learning. It's not really faking. You're learning how to behave in a certain way you want to behave. The more you study about it, the more you act in that way, the more it becomes part of your personality.
Okay.
So it is kind of like you act the way you want to be. It's like dress for the role you want to have. You've heard that before. Well, you go to college for the degree of the job you want, right? So you're doing the things that get you to that point. You go take a training class, maybe in karate or in dance or in music, because that you'd like to be a guitarist. You'd like to see yourself as a guitarist. You take lessons. 5 years from now, all of a sudden you're a guitarist. So you didn't go out that first day and say, I'm a guitarist. It's like, I want to be a guitarist. I start doing the things that guitarists do.
Okay.
And I become. So there's a limited amount of faking. Mm-hmm. You actually have to know.
It's practice after you make it. That's the new version.
Continue to practice.
Yeah.
Whoops. I'm going to jump to critical thinking. No. Here we go. I like this one because it was the end of that list. It was called develop soft skills. When you develop soft skills, your drama provides an awareness of soft skills. You learn to emotionally interact with people because you're being trained to do it. You acquire gestures, how to move your body, your face, your tone of voice. Vary it according to what you're trying to convey. Explore how to deal with feelings, especially when you're reacting to various different situations. And finally, this is all part of development of emotional intelligence.
Hmm. It's also out of observation. Typically, we say one of the first skills is observe yourself, how are you doing? So if you are in part of this drama technique, you have to observe yourself more.
So in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, I was in children's theater. I wasn't a child at the time. I was one of the adults who would be in the play. It was an adult group providing plays for children. We'd have a group of kids from high school age up to adults in their 40s, 50s, 60s, all in this group and working together. But what was really interesting, or should I say, and what was really interesting, when you got some high school kids who tried out for the first time mm-hmm. for a play, and they wanted to act, and you would push them to be like, okay, if you're angry, I want you screaming, yelling, I want you throwing something, and just get out of your comfort zone, go over the top, make it like the worst angry person you can ever do, and they would do that. And you'd see this huge amount of relief come over them because now they're like going, okay, I know I did this over the top, but instead of just like trying to get there slowly, they're experimenting. And the experimentation with emotions and seeing how someone changes from the first day of rehearsal to the time performance comes, it's tremendous. So you do see the development of people, how they interact with people, how they develop their emotions. And it really, the other thing it does is it builds a bond between the people that are performing.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So some of the things that you can do are role play. This is drama for kids. They can do various roles. Improvisation, we talked about. That's a lot of creative work and thinking about situations and quickly on your feet coming up with what you say next.
Yeah.
So what is that? Extemporaneous?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little bit of extemporaneous speech. But it's not on a subject you may know. You may take something from your life and relate it to what you're talking about. But it could also be, I'm going to try something that I wouldn't try in my life because it's improvisation. I can try this. I wouldn't try this at home with my parents or with my friends, But no, in this protected class, I can.
You see the comedian when have the show, they sometimes ask questions with somebody in the audience, and this is improvisation. Mm. Depend of the answer, the person, the people immediately create a joke and some situation. So that is, if feel confident they do this challenge, you know?
So one of the biggest challenges I ever had in theater was doing dinner theater. Mm-hmm. Because it was not only doing a play, but you were interacting with everybody in the audience during the play. So you'd walk through, you'd talk to people, you would do the play. And it was this, it really pushed you to know your lines and be really comfortable walking around and talking with people in that kind of situation. Which, if you've never been in theater, it expands and pushes your boundaries, mm-hmm. which then makes you much more comfortable in the boundaries you're normally are in.
Yeah.
Spontaneity, we talked about that. Pantomime, where you don't get to use your voice, you only get to use your body. That's another thing that was helping the children. Puppet shows. Now you're taking a personality, you're putting it in a puppet, and the puppet is your personality. And having done puppet shows before, it is so cool when you are seeing the puppet on camera or on TV. You don't see yourself, you only see the puppet, and you're now living vicariously through this puppet because it takes on its own life. And it's a little bit strange at times because you're like, you see it and you don't believe, like when you're done, you don't believe it's you, especially when it's the spontaneous stuff where you're coming up with stuff as you go. Is this our third segment? It is.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. So how to develop your own self-confidence. And here's seven steps. And we can talk a little bit about it as we go through. So this is not the children version. This is the adult version. Although everything we spoke about for children, adults, please, if you like drama, like theater, get involved. You'll learn a lot. If you want to do something else, that also, what is it? Toastmasters is a very good way
to have confidence. Yeah.
To at least you'll feel by putting yourself in a group of people who are your friends and support group to help you through a series of presentations on subjects you don't know yet. But in order to talk in front of people, it really helps build your self-confidence for when you now have to talk about a subject you know. To people maybe you don't know, but it's a step towards. And this is part of, and I think we talk about this at one point, but it's part of cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm afraid of public speaking, so I want to move towards it. What's my first step? First, I have to approach and not avoid my fear. Mm-hmm. I have to analyze what my fear is, and then I have to see what is the first step I can do. And when you talk about behavioral, it's what's a behavior I can do right now? Well, I can learn to present to very easy. I can do it amongst friends, something simple. It's only going to be 30 seconds. I'm just going to introduce myself. Icebreaker. Mm-hmm. And then you do more and more and more. But it's almost like you're doing a cognitive behavioral therapy on yourself by determining where you want to be, which would say, okay, I'll be self-confident if I can do this, or task-specific self-confidence if I could do this. And what is my first step in doing that? So Toastmasters is another way to do that.
So you want to share that?
I do. I will share this now. Mm-hmm. So to develop and maintain confidence, think of this in an office environment or job related, that you want to, in the way you determine self-confidence is really yourself. You need to interpret your own performance experiences. And to the extent that you rate yourself successful and good, and I've done a good job, and I was well prepared, and I was comfortable and not anxious, that helps build your confidence. You need to, in order to do that, you need to monitor your emotional and physical states. I'm going to take this off so we can talk. So when you monitor your emotional and physical states, am I having anxiety? How do I not have anxiety? Mm-hmm. My physical state, am I hurt? We were talking about someone dancing, mm-hmm. and somebody who is exhilarated about dancing, they might have hurt themselves dancing, but they're just like, I loved it, it was great. Where somebody who felt like the performance was bad was like, oh, my leg hurt. They were coming up with excuses. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know,
auto-sabotage.
So you understand yourself is that talk positively. You know, you're talking about faking it. You know what? I did good. And look at the, if you did 10 minutes of something and 6 minutes were good and 4 minutes were so, focus on those 6 minutes of what you did good, what you did well. We were just talking about this the other day. Mm-hmm. Focus on your strengths and build your strengths. It's far easier to build your strengths than it is to try to build your weaknesses.
Yeah, and also that the human typical is focused for your weakness versus your strength.
Yeah.
So I remember years ago I interviewed an owner of the company, and he said, when you drive the car and you see the hole in the street, you always go to the direction and you try to see the hole, watch the area that you go and your car avoid the hole. And I start to practice this because typically you see the moment you go immediately. So that is the same for your weakness.
And that's exactly what they tell you in motorcycle classes,
mm-hmm.
is that you will go where you look. If you want to go left, you look left. You want to go right, you look right. You don't look left and go right. You know, so if you see something you want to avoid and you're looking at it, you tend to start leaning towards it.
Yeah.
So it's like you want to drive not in your rearview mirror, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to drive to where you want to go, not what you want to avoid. The other things here, listen to coaches and cheerleaders. Have somebody who's in your bullpen, not in your bullpen, like they're on your side. They want to help you. They watch what you do. They can give you positive feedback. They can help you on some, maybe a little bit of criticism, but really focus on what you're doing well, what you could do better on, but make it a positive experience and have somebody who's got your back. Listen to your cheerleaders. If someone tells you you did a good job, you know what? I did a good job. Don't start telling them, well, I could have done better here or there or there. You know that. You're going to work on those things. But what you want to feel is, yes, you know what? If they think I did a good job, I need to believe I did a good job too. Role models. Use role models as a comparison. You may not be ready to do something, but if there's somebody in your organization and you say, you know what, they do it and they do that well, you know what, I can be like them, maybe not today, but it gives you ability to go from where you are to where they are, thinking it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
You can achieve
it. That's good.
Belief, right?
Yeah.
Reduce anxiety. Again, we talk about anxiety is the unknown. You want to approach the anxiety, you want to move towards it in order to see what it really is, and then you come up with methods, behaviors, and techniques to get not around, but right through that anxiety. How do I go from being scared to present to becoming a presenter? Again, steps. I want to do Toastmasters, I want to do something small, I want to learn my subject really well, so if anybody asks me a question, I know the answer. That if I don't know the subject well, and I'm scared of presenting, and I've not practiced, that's another one, practice. You want to practice. Visualize you being successful. See yourself as being successful. And practice, right?
Yeah.
And then proactive self-leadership. The proactive self-leadership part is, as we said, is take steps to move you from where you are to where you want to go. We're zooming to the end here, and here it is. Here is our takeaway slide. You ready?
Okay.
Got confidence, focus on strengths. 1, acquire new skills and learn new knowledge. Use neuroplasticity to your advantage to make you stronger and to avoid self-sabotage. Build your strengths. Challenge yourself and set deadlines. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it by this date. It gives you something to work towards, and as you see yourself achieving it, you'll become more confident. The path to achievement is where all the confidence comes from. If I know I need 10 steps, and I made it to step one, and I'm on my way to step two. You ever do martial arts?
Yes.
If you go from white belt to yellow belt, you're not black belt yet. That might be your goal, but hey, I made it to yellow. I learned this. I mastered this. Now what's next?
And the discipline, so you go every day, do the
discipline.
Practice, yeah.
Things to challenge yourself for self-confidence, physical health, fitness, dance, martial arts we talk about. So we had the physical side, the art, theater, photography, painting, performance, some kind of performance. So using your mind and creativity as well. Take a class on cooking, learn an instrument, travel. And when you travel, just don't go for the travel, but read about where you're going, look at the restaurants you're going to go to, see what the culture is like locally. When you start getting involved in learning about these things, you are building your brain. Your brain is becoming bigger. You're becoming more self-confident. Mm-hmm. Also, don't forget about spiritual and emotional. Is that the more relaxed, the more at peace with who we are, where we're going in life, where we're going in this world, and where we're going after, the more peaceful, the less anxiety, and the more able we're going to be to reach our goals. Thank you for listening to 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette.
And Jim.
Have a great week.
See you the next.
You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lizette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.